Traditional markers of adulthood are getting a job, getting married, having kids, maybe buying a house. But Americans are getting married later or not at all, and they're waiting longer to have children, too. A recent report from Zillow shows first-time homebuyers are waiting longer than ever before to move from renting to owning. With all these societal changes, when do you really become an adult?
What do you think defines adulthood? What marks that transition? When did you really feel like you became an adult, or you still feel like you're not quite grown up yet? Call in and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Julie Beck joins us now. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and she writes about health and psychology. You can find a link to her piece, When Are You Really an Adult, on the Central Time Facebook page. And she joins us from studios at The Atlantic. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, like we mentioned there, we have this traditional idea, almost this leave it to beaver idea of what it means to be an adult. You've got your marriage, your kids, buying a house. Where did that all come from?
It's really interesting. I do like to call it the leave it to beaver markers. And it's funny because they really only ever all arrived for somebody, you know, in a relatively short period of time, for a couple of decades right after World War II. So, you know, people still want those things. You know, people still want to get married or have kids, you know, buy a house, you know, depending on who it is. But these things are happening later and later. But we're just comparing it to this, you know, pretty anomalous time in our history when, you know, the economy was really prospering. And a lot of times people didn't even need, you know, a high school diploma to get a job that could support a family, which is very rarely the case these days. So when we're saying, you know, people are taking longer to grow up because they're not getting these things, they're waiting too long to sort of achieve these roles, we're really only comparing them to a pretty unfair yardstick.
Now, we hear about this all the time in association with millennials, that the economy is bad, so they don't have the financial stability, say, to buy a house or maybe even to get married. But you said this really wasn't the norm except for the post-World War II era. So what other generations have struggled with this besides millennials?
Yeah, I mean, so this is, I talked to, you know, a historian of adulthood who was really the one who was saying, you know, it's really only after World War II that people had these things so quickly. And even before that, you know, in the 19th century, that really wasn't the case. A lot of times young men would have to wait for their fathers to die to get married so they could get their inheritance. And, you know, hopefully people who are getting married later today are doing it for, like, slightly less morbid reasons than that. And, you know, I mentioned as an example in my piece, Henry Thoreau, the famous writer. He, you know, moved back in with his parents after he graduated from Harvard and then moved out and then moved back in again and cycled through jobs for like 12 years.
Crashed with a friend.
Yeah, crashed with his buddy Ralph Waldo Emerson. So I mean, even relatively successful people from the past were living in this way.
Does that mean we may have these unrealistic ideas, these sort of out of the... not really the pages of history, but I guess the pages of television or popular imagination about adulthood that are really not what it means to be an adult today?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, a certain veneration of that era. I mean, you know, they call people, you know, the greatest generation, and people who have seen that modeled either in their own families or through media, as you said, may have this idea in their mind that that's what it means to be an adult, and you take on all these roles, you know, maybe within the couple years after you graduate or move out of your parents' house, and then boom, you're an adult. But for a lot of people, it really doesn't work that way.
Well, looking at what it means to be an adult, you dug into some different definitions, legal, religious, and biological. Let's start with legal. Legally, is there anything that's going to help us out here when we are trying to talk about what it means to be an adult?
It's funny because I wanted to try and find, you know, the simplest possible definition of the boundary between childhood and adulthood. And I was like, okay, let's just start with the law. And you would say, okay, you're an adult at 18. But, like, not really. You know, you get certain adult responsibilities at 18. You can vote. You can join the military. But you can't drink till you're 21. And by the time you're 18, you know, you're already allowed to watch adult movies. And you can hold a job in many states as young as 14. And so even within the realm of the law, whether you're an adult depends on the responsibility that you're talking about.
Well, what about religion, which might offer different coming of age ceremonies that maybe in the past would have been sort of a more clear marker of, yes, now you are a man or a woman?
Yeah, I mean, there are coming-of-age ceremonies that people still do go through, you know, bar and bat mitzvahs, Catholic confirmations. A quinceañera is not really a religious ceremony, I don't think, but, you know, it's a coming-of-age ceremony that someone might have. But, again, that only gives you adulthood within certain realms. You know, once you're 13 and you've had a bar mitzvah, that doesn't mean you can go vote. You know, there's still restrictions in other areas of culture.
And then lastly, let's look at biology here. I mean, that seems kind of the most logical. You look at body and brain here. Is there evidence that we can point a finger and say, yep, that's adulthood?
Yeah, once again, I was looking for the simple answer that I couldn't find. I mean, you can say, you know, once you're sexually mature, you're mature, but that's, you know, problematic because if you're, you know, 14, 15 and you're done with puberty, like, that people aren't going to say that you're, you know, old enough to have a relationship with an adult. And as far as brain goes, you know, there's a lot of different areas that develop, and it again depends on what you're talking about, because the brain scientist I was talking to was saying, you know, your logical reasoning is pretty much developed by 16, and so he thinks, you know, there shouldn't be any reason why 16-year-olds can't vote. Their logic is perfectly good, but the connections that kind of help you control your impulsivity and things like that are not fully developed, and so that comes later, sometimes even into the early 20s.
We're talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic right now, talking about the question, what makes an adult? And another term that you looked into, which is maybe a little more helpful when we try to think about what makes an adult, especially today when a lot of the markers that we think of as denoting adulthood are hard to come by. And this is the concept of emerging adulthood, sort of that it's this phase of years where you're sort of growing into yourself. Explain what that means.
Yeah, so that's a new life stage that has been named by Jeffrey Jensen Arnett, and so there's some debate over whether it is a new life stage. You know, when you're, you know, 18 to 25 or 18 to 29, sometimes they'll say that this is a new life stage where you are not quite, you're not an adolescent anymore, but you're working up to being an adult. Some people would just say that adolescence has been extended to go into the early 20s, and that has a lot to do with, you know, people taking on roles later, as you said, but it also has a lot to do with people's subjective evaluations as to whether they are an adult or not. You know, if they just don't feel like an adult, then can we call them one?
Do other people buy into that idea of emerging adulthood?
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten a lot of coverage, and I think, you know, I'm certainly not the one to say whether it's a life stage or whether it's not, but it is an interesting concept because I think it recognizes a lot of both the societal things that are happening and the way people are thinking about adulthood for themselves.
Well, it's an interesting topic because it, without these markers that we're talking about, if you threw those out, it really comes down to how you feel. Do you feel like an adult? And then the question is, what makes you feel like an adult? And you asked people this. You got some opinions. What kinds of things did people tell you?
Yeah, we put out a call to readers, and we got really just a huge variety of responses. Everybody seems to have, you know, different moments that they kind of realized for themselves, or it was just a creeping sensation that kind of came upon them slowly. So the only, you know, themes of things that I saw over and over again were two things. One was having kids, and one was the loss of a parent. And so those two seem to be really like flip the switch moments for people, but a lot of times it's a lot more gradual than that.
Right, and some people were resentful over the notion that you had to have kids to be an adult. I think there was a quote that I read where a friend's father told one person who was commenting to you, you never really grew up, and it was basically because she hadn't had kids. And so there are all these assumptions about what kids do to you, and it might be that you feel like an adult, and it might be that they don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very fraught issue, you know. Everybody wants to have opinions on whether or not other people should have kids. But I think I would never say that you have to have kids to be an adult. I think that a lot of people who do have kids feel that that was a very defining moment for them. And this is just me sort of interpreting the letters that I received. But it seems for a lot of other people, moving into a caretaking role for a parent can also be that kind of moment. Or, you know, it comes upon you in incremental stages, and you don't, you know, one day go into the hospital and come out with someone you're responsible for. But that doesn't mean that these same processes and a growing up is not happening in other ways.
Did you ever think about whether maybe there really is no such thing as being an adult, that our self-conception sort of freezes early on, and that's just what it is, and there is no such thing as adulthood, really.
Oh, I mean, adulthood is completely, you know, a social construct. As, you know, I was saying, if you try and break it down into actual things that can be measured in terms of, you know, biology or psychology or brain science, there's a million different measures that you can choose, and you'll get something different every time. So, I mean, but it's a construct that's important because it determines, you know, what responsibilities we let people take on in society. It determines how we view each other and how we view ourselves. But that doesn't mean it's not something we totally made up.
We're talking to Julie Beck right now from The Atlantic, talking about what it means to be an adult when you know.
And we want to hear your thoughts on this now at 800-642-1234. When did you first feel like an adult? Was there a moment, an event, a transition in your life, or you're still waiting? What is it going to take to make you feel grown up? What do you think makes people be an adult? Why do you think the line between childhood and adulthood feels so blurry these days? When do you think of your kids as adults, if ever? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with Atlantic editor Julie Beck about what it really means to be an adult.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your definition of an adult? When do you think people make that transition from childhood or teenhood to adulthood? What made you feel like you'd taken that step? You're an adult now. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our phones now and take our first call from Laura in Madison. Laura, hi.
Oh, hi. Hey, I heard a show on National Public Radio last year about this topic, and I'd love your guests' take on it. The people they had on that show said there were three criteria that you have to be an adult. You have to stop depending on your parents financially, so you provide for yourself completely financially. You have to go out into the world and see the world without your parents' lens and form some opinions about the world that are uniquely yours, that are different from those of your parents. So those are the first two. Mm-hmm. You have to be financially independent of your parents and intellectually independent of your parents. The third one, they said, was the hardest one for people, and that is to no longer need your parents to be the perfect role models, to be perfect archetypes, to be all-knowing and all-powerful and all-loving, and to recognize that they're just human beings. They make mistakes, and to forgive them for that and to relate to them as people and try to develop an adult relationship with them that doesn't involve, you know, old resentments. And
Laura, thank you so much for those thoughts that you heard. Those are interesting points there. What do you think about those, Julie?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I would love to hear that show. So it reminds me, it's pretty similar to when, you know, the psychologist who studies emerging adulthood, who coined that term, when he was doing interviews with people about whether they felt like an adult or not, there were three things that came up for them repeatedly, which are not quite exactly the same but similar, which are financial independence, so that one is the same, and then feeling like you've taken responsibility for your actions and feeling like you are independent. And a lot of those things are defined, you know, in relation to your parents because, you know, who are you financially independent from or what have you. I think the bit about sort of seeing your parents as people and not as, you know, the perfect, all-powerful people who take care of you, I think that's really something. I think that comes up a lot for people, and especially in terms when people are talking about, you know, having to move into caretaking roles for parents or when a parent dies and that making them feel a lot like an adult. I think that's coming from a similar place, you know, where they see that they're the ones that have to take care of their parents or they're the ones that have to take care of themselves.
Do you think having that first one, the financial one, and you talked about this too, obviously, in your piece, makes it difficult to be completely financially independent? Because in the economy today, you graduate at the wrong time, the job market is rough, the economy is rough. I mean, maybe by that yardstick, you're not an adult until you're 50 years old.
Well, maybe. You know, I think that is something that's important to people, and some, you know, reader letters that we got people would say, well, you know, I'm living with my parents, so I don't feel like I'm totally an adult yet. But a lot of times people will report that they feel like an adult in some ways and not in other ways. And I think, I mean, that's kind of, you know, the sort of herky-jerky path to adulthood that a lot of people take is, you know, you mature in some ways faster and in some ways slower. And some days you don't feel like an adult in a particular way, and some days you do. And I think it's, you know, part of the process.
We're talking to Julie Beck right now from The Atlantic Magazine, talking about how you know when you're an adult, what it takes to be an adult. And we'll go back to our phones now, take a call from Maggie in Janesville. Maggie, hi.
Hi. So I am glad that, you know, Julie and you guys all got to talking about the financial independence aspect. For me, I graduated just a couple of years ago, and I have $50,000 in debt. And for, you know, for some people, that's nothing compared to what they have. But for me, it's enough that it's crippling, and I cannot move out on my own right now. You know, I've taken a job in Brookfield, and I live in Janesville, so commuting is cheaper than trying to live on my own.
So you have a job, and you graduated from college. Those are two important benchmarks. So, Maggie, do you feel like an adult despite that, or do you think the financial stuff is holding you back?
I think the financial stuff is holding me back. I'm definitely one of those people that if I could pay, you know, my phone and my car insurance instead of my family having to, I surely would. And I, you know, I want them to not have to carry that burden anymore, but I'm just not at that point yet.
Well, Maggie, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate that. And Julie, does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty common story. You know, and the financial thing has been pretty important for me in terms of, you know, feeling like I'm an adult. But I think there's still, you know, a sense of, okay, yes, like I can pay for my life. I'm responsible for my life, and that's really great. But that's not to say that there aren't tons of ways in which I can still continue to grow up and maybe need to still continue to grow up.
Appreciate that call. And we're going to go next to Mark in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
What did you want to add?
It just made me think about when I right after I turned 30, I had this mentor that was kind of helping me through some rough patches in life, and I called him, and I said, I told him I had a realization, and that was that I can't have everything I want. And he said that was a pretty good realization to have. And I felt, after that, I just kind of felt like I was an adult, like I'd never felt like an adult before. And after that, I have felt like I've grown up. I just realized that, you know, there were certain things about my life that I wanted to be different, and they can't always be. And just accepting that, I felt like I grew up.
Oh, that's great. Mark, thank you for that. Acceptance was really important to Mark, and knowing that he couldn't have everything he wanted, but that he accepted that, that's an interesting way to look at that. What do you think about that one, Julie?
Yeah, I think the realism can sometimes be important. It's interesting. The Emerging Adulthood guy in his book was writing about how a lot of times for people, the 20s are a really hard decade, but they're also like very hopeful. And so people still think that, you know, okay, like I'm still living with my parents, or I'm struggling in these ways, but I can definitely like still get that like shiny life that I want. And a lot of times, you know, as he said, you know, it's certain things just aren't possible, and that can be hard, but probably also a sort of growing up realization.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Mark, and we'll go next to Stan in Caledonia. Hi, Stan.
Hi. I was actually having this debate with my good friend Kyle on New Year's Eve, and we were talking about when we felt like we became an adult, because I told him that in many ways for me, it was when I had the financial independence where I didn't have to rely on my parents anymore. And Kyle was saying that in some way he felt like the government and the state had actually defined it to him, because when he was, I believe, 16 or 17, he had been charged as an adult because he got busted for having a fat bag of nuggets and had to go to jail as an adult.
Wow, so different experiences there. Stan, thanks a lot for sharing that. And so obviously you've got a legal thing tried as an adult. You probably feel quite a lot like an adult at that point. So Julie, what about some of those markers that are kind of, to coin a phrase, thrust upon us, like Hamlet says?
Yeah, the legal aspect is really, really interesting, because I think a lot of the brain science and things that I was talking about you know, how certain impulsive connections aren't formed until later life is being considered by the legal system to sort of think about whether people should, you know, for sentences for juveniles and whether they should be susceptible to life sentences. That was kind of referred to in a Supreme Court case from a few years ago. So they're looking at that and they're thinking about that. But a lot of times, so someone else that I interviewed for the piece, you know, I was kind of going around asking all my sources, when is somebody really an adult? When is somebody really an adult? And he was like, well, you know, the question that I would want to ask is, when is somebody really a child? Because a lot of times people are sort of forced into these adult roles and responsibilities or consequences that they maybe aren't ready for.
Let's go and take one more call here. Kurt is joining us from Wind Point. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I was just going to comment that this is in the 70s, when I moved to Key West, Florida, where my brother lived, and I left my childhood home to move down there, the very first time I ran out of toothpaste and had to then go buy toothpaste, that was the moment I knew I was an adult. I had never before bought any of that kind of stuff for myself. It just magically appeared in our home.
It was a toothpaste purchase for Kurt. Something, you know, one of those moments that just hits you like a lightning bolt. Did a lot of people have answers like that, Julie? Just very specific, this moment.
Yeah, he reminds me very closely of someone who emailed and said that it was not when they bought their first pack of floss, but when they bought their second pack of floss, when it ran out and they were like, dang, I better buy another one. That's when it was really an adult.
Well, Julie, it's been fun. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That was Julie Beck, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. We talked to her about what it really means to be an adult. And you can find a link to her piece and share your story over on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. When President Barack Obama visited La Crosse earlier this month, he drew comparisons between the economies of Wisconsin and Minnesota. He said Wisconsin put trickle-down economics into practice and Minnesota put middle-class economics into practice. And he went on to cite Minnesota's lower unemployment rate and higher median income, saying Minnesota is winning the border war.
Our next guest disagrees. He wrote a recent op-ed titled Wisconsin's Business Climate Outshines Minnesota. He's with us today to lay out that argument. Kurt Bauer is the president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, great to be on.
Now, what did you think when you first heard President Obama's assertion that Minnesota's economy is stronger than Wisconsin's because he said of different policies?
We've heard that before. It's been a common talking point since Governor Walker took over, and then, of course, you've had Governor Mark Dayton. The two could not be more polar opposites in their approach to economic policies. And so the comparison is obvious. The concern I had was that I don't think it was put in proper context from the standpoint that, frankly, I do think that Minnesota is winning the border battle, but they have been for a long time. And there are a variety of systemic reasons for that. But what I wanted to point out that I do think that Wisconsin is taking the necessary steps to repair our business climate so that we are more competitive going forward. Minnesota's taken an opposite tact, but I think it's going to be, you know, 10 years or so for this case study to really play itself out, and we'll have to see what Wisconsin and what Minnesota looks like after that time period.
Yeah, through various elections, Kurt, we've been watching monthly or quarterly jobs reports to see if there are upticks, looking at job creation rates. Both sides, pro or con, on Governor Walker, pulling out the numbers that are right for them. You say the numbers that are happening now aren't really telling the whole story. So what kind of things are you saying are building a success in the future?
Well, since 2013, Wisconsin has improved in every major economic ranking or report card, which shows that we're making progress. Now, that doesn't mean that we're surpassing Minnesota or even other states in the upper Midwest. You look at all of the different types of metrics that people look at, income, and Wisconsin's actually outpacing Minnesota right now in income growth. But that maybe isn't as great as it sounds from the standpoint that Minnesota has higher income than we do, and you know, we really have no place to go but up. You look at job growth. Well, we didn't get as hit as hard during the economic downturn of the Great Recession, so we didn't have as far of a hole to climb out of. All of these things have to be put in proper context. And what we can do is try and control what destiny we can. You know, Wisconsin is only 2% of the national economy. I don't know what that translates into the global economy. But the reality is that we're somewhat of a windsock economy. We don't control our own destiny. But what we can control are some of the policies that attract business investment here, which will grow jobs ultimately and lead to a better quality of life for Wisconsinites.
And what kind of things would you point to over the last 4 years or so in terms of state economic policy that would help us do that?
We always talk about at WMC as the holy trinity of taxes, regulation, and litigation. We're trying to reduce the cost of doing business in the state and make it easier to do business in the state from a permitting standpoint. And we have reduced taxes in the state. We need to do more. We would like to see Wisconsin get out of the infamous top 10. We're still a high tax state. That's a problem for us. And it does matter. You do see businesses and investment go where there is lower taxes. Particularly, you see the brain drain, and this relates to how we have scored recently on entrepreneurship. The Kauffman Institute or the foundation recently said we're 50th in entrepreneurship. Well, one of the reasons I think you can blame on that is the fact that our tax rate encourages people when they retire to take their wealth to a low tax jurisdiction like Arizona or Florida, which ultimately handicaps us for startups and venture capital.
A counter argument is often that, yes, taxes and regulations are part of what businesses are looking for. They're also looking for places with a good quality of life where they can find educated employees who want to live there. So is it worth maybe keeping some of the taxes up to pay for those quality of life worker training types of services?
Absolutely. And I think at the state level, the two most important things you can invest in are infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, particularly important in Wisconsin because our three largest business sectors, manufacturing, agriculture, and tourism, all rely on good roads and infrastructure, and then, of course, education. So you do have to make those types of investments, but we have. We've got a world-class university system. We've probably got the best tech college system in the world. We've got, by and large, good K-12. We've got some pockets where we need reform and we need to see better results. But by and large, we have those things. So does Minnesota. So you have to look at systemically, why is Minnesota outperforming us? And the research that I've done on this, probably the biggest reason is that they've got a concentration of population within the Twin Cities area, whereas Wisconsin's population is more dispersed. One of the things that does for them is it allows for greater job mobility and more competition for job, which really does crank up incomes in Minnesota as compared to Wisconsin.
Talking to Kurt Bauer, President and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, about the comparison that President Obama, a lot of other people have been making between the economies of Wisconsin and Minnesota. So let's talk about the university system a little more as an economic driver. You mentioned that's something we've got here in the state. So does Minnesota. UW system taking some significant budget cuts again in the newest budget. Is that a concern for you that we may be cutting the budget to something that's key to our economic future?
I think we do have to watch it. The University of Wisconsin system, and I'm a product of it, a UW-Madison grad, so you know I have some allegiance here, but I think we have to watch the cuts there, but we also have to take a look at it in its totality. We have a very expensive secondary education delivery system in Wisconsin. We've got 13 four-year campuses, we've got 13 two-year campuses, then we've got 16 technical colleges with 49 locations. That's 75 locations. At some point, we're probably going to have to look at, as we look at the demographics, can taxpayers afford to maintain all of those campuses? And frankly, is there going to be enrollment demand for that many campuses?
You mentioned the Twin Cities as a concentrated economic area. And in your piece, you contrast that with Milwaukee. Also, you say the Twin Cities are, in many ways, the only game in town in their region. Milwaukee sandwiched between Chicago and the Twin Cities. Do you see ways to harness the power of our biggest urban region of the state?
I think Milwaukee is a great asset for the state. I think it could be more so. Yeah, I was just at Summerfest with my wife and enjoying walking along the Third Ward. You know, Minnesota, the Twin Cities has a river. Milwaukee's got a river. It also has a great lake and one of the most beautiful lakefronts. I think the answer is absolutely, but I think we need a plan to harness the power of Milwaukee and to attract people. I frankly think that, you know, they have their twin cities, we have ours. Madison and Milwaukee are important urban centers for Wisconsin. And that's particularly important because the data shows millennials really want urban living. And we've got to make sure that Milwaukee and Madison can compete to attract young urban professionals.
Now, let's go to the other side of the border for a moment. You said current stats, Minnesota looking pretty good, but some of the things you see changing there you think are going to be bad for the future of business there. What kind of changes do you see there?
Well, Governor Dayton is raising taxes. He's raising the cost of doing business on regulation, adding more and more obstacles to doing business in that state. They increased the minimum wage, which shows that it costs people jobs. It is not pro-competitive. It is not viewed by the business community as something they see as attractive. So I think they're really heading in the opposite direction. And in fact, recently, the CNBC study came out, and Minnesota ranked higher than Wisconsin. Wisconsin moved up in that ranking, but Minnesota was still higher. And I got an email from my friends at the Minnesota Chamber, you know, wondering why that is, because they see a problem up there, whereas here in Wisconsin, we've got 90% of our business members believe that Wisconsin's heading in the right direction. That's not the case in Minnesota. And business optimism does matter. Optimistic businesses hire, pessimistic ones don't.
Now, you've said it's too early to measure the success of Governor Walker's reforms when it comes to business. When do you think we'll start to see some of these reforms paying off in job growth, income growth, other measures?
Well, like I said, I think that we're really dependent on the national and the global economies. I think we're going to have to see a sustained growth in those two economies before Wisconsin really begins to churn. I just don't think that at 2% of the national economy that we can really do it on our own. I think you're going to have to realistically, though, look at this 5 to 10 years out to see what kind of changes, what kind of impacts there were from Governor Walker's reforms versus Governor Dayton's reforms. I think it takes that long.
Kurt, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Kurt Bauer. He's president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce with us to talk about why he says Wisconsin's long-term business climate is looking better than Minnesota's.
We just heard from Kurt Bauer of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about how he says Wisconsin's business climate outshines Minnesota's. He wrote his opinion piece in response to remarks by President Obama that Minnesota was doing better economically than Wisconsin because of middle-class economics. You can find a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jennifer Epps Addison joins us now for another perspective. She's the executive director at Wisconsin Jobs Now. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what was your reaction to President Obama making the case that our neighbors in Minnesota are better off because of their different approach to economic policy?
Look, I think the president was responding to a number of sources that have also cited the fact that Minnesota's economy seems to be far outpacing Wisconsin's. And while Mr. Bauer's piece was interesting, you know, it was an opinion piece, it wasn't based on a lot of fact. In fact, he didn't really have a single citation from a credible source to back up the claim that Wisconsin is outshining Minnesota. There is one clear piece from Forbes magazine. In November of 2014, Forbes magazine listed Minnesota as the 9th best state in the nation for business, citing quality of life, better education, and a healthy population as a few of the reasons. On the other hand, Governor Walker's Wisconsin was ranked number 32.
The idea, the case Kurt Bauer was making is that long run, higher taxes going up in Minnesota, taxes going down in Wisconsin, regulations, similar trends. Long term, that's going to bring more business to Wisconsin, less to Minnesota. You don't buy that?
I don't buy it at all. Look, you know, you have the example of the South, right? And they have incredibly low taxes in the South, and that is not the primary reason why businesses choose to locate there, particularly the type of growth industries we're looking at. You know, our governor is claiming that we need a more educated workforce in order to attract businesses and to restart our economy, and yet our governor has had the largest cuts the second highest cuts in public education in the country and the largest cuts we've seen in Wisconsin. You know, by comparison, Minnesota invested in education. They raised taxes and they reinvested that money into education. They increased the minimum wage so that workers are earning enough to support their families, and they those workers then turn around and spend in their local economies. I think we have to understand that a $1.6 billion cut to public education in governor's first term, coupled with the $250 million cut to the UW system, are exactly the types of decisions and priorities that are seriously hindering our state's ability to come out of and emerge out of the Great Recession.
Now, Minnesota has generally fared better than Wisconsin economically for a while now. Do you think it's fair to put the blame or the credit on the policies of the respective governors there?
Well, I think that it's fair to put I think it's about budget priorities, and I think that, you know, our economic decisions and our budget decisions have economic consequences. So you look, for instance, at Minnesota investing in education, and we know that for, you know, you see an incredible return on investments in education, not just in having a more highly educated workforce, but also in terms of the economic stimulus of investing in education. You look at Minnesota and their decision to take Medicaid expansion funds, which Governor Walker refuses to do, and even as we had to cut hundreds of millions of dollars from our prized university system, the Republicans in the state legislature have refused to do. And then you see that, you know, you hear the statistics that Minnesota has now has the lowest premiums in the entire country because they've taken this money and they've prioritized in making sure that every one of their citizens has access to affordable coverage. Valuing the health of your citizens is an economy-boosting policy, one that we are not taking on here in the state of Wisconsin that we should be. And in fact, that the majority of the state believes that we should be doing. So you have to look at what's really driving this. And the reality is that in Mr. Bauer's opinion and in Governor Walker's administration, corporations and what's best for the profits of corporations are what's driving their economic decisions. And what we're saying, what we say at Wisconsin Jobs Now, what our hundreds of members across the state are saying is that we think that what is in the best interest of the everyday person, the person who gets up and works hard, the person who is working two or three jobs, the person who doesn't know how they're going to cover their light bill and their rent this month, we think that investing and focusing our economic decision-making on what's in the best interest of those folks, how do we expand opportunity to those folks, how do we get a greater share of our population into the middle class, that is what is going to drive a healthy economy for Wisconsin, and that those are the priorities that our governor and that our business community should be focusing on.
Talking to Jennifer Epps Addison, she's executive director at Wisconsin Jobs Now, looking at Wisconsin's economy in part in comparison with Minnesota's. A lot of people have made that comparison, including President Obama when he was visiting La Crosse earlier this month. Jennifer, an issue you and Wisconsin Jobs Now have worked on a lot is the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Make the case that minimum wage increases would do what you said, bring more people into the middle class.
I mean, absolutely. Look, 70% of the country's economy is consumer spending. So we already know that if folks are making too little to be able to actually go out and spend in the economy, then our economy is going to stall. When you look at a state like Wisconsin, we actually had the largest decline in middle-class income in the entire country. And we're feeling that in terms of the growth of our economy. If we want to get our economy moving more rapidly, then we need to put more money in the pockets of folks who are going to go out and spend that money every day. But I think we need to be clear that this is not some unearned benefit. This is not charity to workers. That, you know, CEO pay and the massive corporations like Walmart and McDonald's are skirting their responsibility to the citizens of our state. We invest heavily in both creating the infrastructure and in providing the workforce so that they can make their profits. And then we turn around and subsidize them through public assistance programs and subsidize their poverty wages. And so Wisconsin Jobs Now has been focused on two things. It's been focused on bringing that reality out of the shadows, but it's been focused on telling the corporations that are operating within our state that they need to pay their fair share, that they cannot claim that they can't afford to pay workers fairly, to pay them enough to actually live on without being on public assistance, and then give CEOs compensation in the rate of 100, or in the case of fast food, 1,000 times more than the average worker. That is bad for the state, it's bad for our communities, and it weakens our overall economic output.
The argument against that, and we heard that from Kurt Bauer just a little while ago, is that you're in effect increasing labor costs for businesses, businesses that have a choice of where to locate. If they get to pay $3 or $5 or $8, depending on the amount, an hour less, why wouldn't they go somewhere else instead of the place that raised its minimum wage?
Well, look, I mean, we've heard this from business community over and over again. It's the sky is falling mentality, but the reality doesn't match it. And the truth is that the places in our country where the economy is growing the fastest, where there's been a rapid increase in economic opportunity, are the same communities in the same states that have actually increased their minimum wage. So I think, you know, what we need to be asking ourselves are, what type of communities are we trying to build, and what does every single Wisconsin citizen deserve, and what should the government's role be in ensuring and maintaining that system? So I would argue, for instance, that rather than subsidizing the profits of corporations, it is the responsibility of our state government to hold those corporations accountable and to ensure that if they're going to operate in our state, that workers are paid enough to live free from the necessity of public assistance, that workers take home enough to meet the basic costs of living, like providing a roof over their heads, taking care of their children, and having a dignified life. That is the promise, actually, that our forefathers in the progressive movement committed to our state when they passed the state's living wage law, when they introduced and passed that living wage law that Governor Walker just essentially removed from his budget. You know, we had a commitment at one point. We had a law on the books for 104 years that said that every single worker in the state shall be paid a living wage, and that wage should be and must be enough for them to live in reasonable comfort and decency. Governor Walker erased that law in his budget in the budget that he just signed, and that is the wrong way forward for our state, and it's going to lead to a continued decline in economic opportunity for our citizens.
And Jennifer, briefly, as we wrap up, apart from minimum wage increases, what would be one more thing that would make Wisconsin's economy stronger, better for the middle class?
Absolutely. We need to deal with scheduling, and we need to deal with the new Wisconsin economy. The reality is that too many people are working part-time jobs and do not have access to full-time work. Governor Walker just made this worse when he signed now in the budget, taking away a guaranteed weekend and forced a seven-day work week on a number of people in our state. So we need to address scheduling. We need fair practices that enable people to make reasonable accommodations for another job, for childcare, for illness. That is how we make a stronger workforce, a workforce that's more reliable, and a workforce at the end of the day that's going to be better for boosting business.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jennifer Epps Addison, Executive Director at Wisconsin Jobs Now, with us to talk about the economic comparisons between Wisconsin and Minnesota. Kurt Bauer from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce also joined us.